Next case this morning is Helfrich against Carl Clinic Association.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel.
Under section 1022 of ERISA, a pension plan participant is entitled to receive a summary plan description, referred to as a SPD, sort of walking around papers so that they know that somewhere in the back room somewhere there is a pension plan and this is the benefit that I'm going to get from that pension plan. In this case, these two doctors went on board at Carl Clinic Association, got their summary plan descriptions.
How do we know that these documents are summary plan descriptions?
They're summary plan descriptions because it's undisputed in the record that these doctors received absolutely nothing else.
No. Assume a plan does not give a summary plan description.
Then they violated ERISA.
If I give you a document summarizing the plan, is that now a summary plan description because you haven't gotten any other summary plan description?
If you're the pension fund, if you're the employer, and you issue the document
Counsel, we need to keep separate the employer and the fund. The reason I'm asking this question is that it looks like the documents you are calling summary plan descriptions were written up by the employer and not by the pension trust. Is that correct?
You know, we weren't allowed any discovery. We don't know where the documents came from. We know they were given to our client because they were employers.
Who purports to be the author of these documents?
One of the documents has the CCA logo. And so you might be absolutely correct. You might be correct that the personnel department of the employer prepared the description on behalf of the employer, meaning to describe the fund. But let's remember, this is a single employer fund, so we don't have the problem of actuarial unsoundness, you know, for other employers. But the premise is that Carl, if there had been a summary plan description, in the face of summary judgment where we're claiming these are the summary plan descriptions.
But wait a minute. I need to ask you about that, too, because I had a similar question to Judge Easterbrook, namely, maybe the plan was in violation of ERISA by not having prepared an SPD, but that's a little bit separate from the question whether these things are SPDs. But putting that to one side, reading your complaint, reading the district court's opinion, his ultimate opinion on the summary judgment motion, it appears to me that the argument you were presenting to the district court had to do with whether the plan had been amended improperly, which is one family of ERISA cases. Now you're raising another point, which one often sees in ERISA, namely whether there's a conflict between the SPD and the plan, if it's the kind of conflict that's a square conflict, we know the SPD controls. On the other hand, we know from the MERS case that silence may not be enough, et cetera. There's a whole, you know, series of things you can
sure
talk about with respect to that. It looks to me like your case was about the first of those two, whether there was an amendment, and that the district court was never alerted to the argument that you're now making.
The very first argument we made was summary plan descriptions are binding.
Where did you, I mean, I...
That
your
if
complaint
in the motion
doesn't say that. There's a separate section even of ERISA that you would have been mentioning along the way.
The complaint refers to the summary plan descriptions as brochure 1, brochure 2.
But the point is the legal argument, there's a conflict between the SPD and the plan, SPD should control.
That's in the motion for summary judgment.
Come through.
That is in the motion for summary judgment. And we actually cite the Matthews versus Sears case, which is the case that says if the shoe is on the other foot and the conflict in summary plan description means greater benefits to the plaintiffs, then they'll get that. In that case, the summary plan description benefited the employer. But because it was the walking around papers that the participants had, the thing that led them to believe this is what your benefits are going to be, it was held to be binding, that the federal law of contracts, common law of contracts, is going to use that because it's what the document that the participant relies upon.
No,
and
I mean, we all know that set of rules. The question is, did you invoke them well enough, and are they triggered by Summary 1, Summary 2, and Summary 3?
We certainly alleged in the complaint we were relying on those documents. They were handed to us as our pension benefit. In our motion for summary judgment, we cited that case. We cited the Matthews case to Judge McCuskey.
And part so he of the, just decided not to put a section in his opinion about that.
That's correct, and counsel didn't even respond to it. They didn't respond to that section of our motion for summary judgment. And in the briefs in this court, they don't respond to that motion or to that notion, to that issue. It's the very first issue of our brief. If you read our brief, you'll see. If you look at their brief, if you look under the table of authorities, it's very confusing because they refer to 1022 and they say it's on pages 3 and 4, but then you look at 3 and 4, it's not there. And the only place you ever see it is on page 19 of their summary of argument where they say, well, they argued 1022, but it's without merit and that it's too late. So Judge McCuskey, it wasn't that he wasn't on notice from us. He wasn't on notice because the defendants never addressed it. They never took the position. As I, in answering to you, Judge Easterbrook, they never came forward and said, wait a minute. Here are the summary plan descriptions. They clearly say there are caps. Because these documents say, here's your formula, and don't forget there's the Social Security offset. Clearly, these summary plan descriptions could have said, and there are caps, and they didn't. And so all these doctors, it isn't just these plaintiffs, 20 doctors all came up with this.
Let me ask one more question about whether these are summary plan descriptions. You say you didn't have any opportunity for discovery. Did you seek any discovery that was directly related to the authorship of these three documents?
We sought discovery of any documents that had been given, where they came from, who promulgated them, who they were given to.
No, part of your problem in this case is you sought discovery of hundreds of things of no conceivable relevance and cheesed off the district judge by defying his discovery orders. It's no surprise that at that point the district judge shut you down.
I think that's a fair assumption.
The question I am asking is whether there was any discovery request, simple, straightforward, who was the author of these three documents?
I can't say that there is a specific interrogatory, because we didn't get to that, that there is a specific request to produce. We wanted to take depositions. We were not allowed. I don't think I was ever in a position to ask that, and I think it's a very good question.
It's very simple to serve a request for admissions on the plan. Would have avoided all the discovery problems you had in the district court.
The summary plan description argument has been successfully avoided by the defendant in this case. It's only because that they've been successful in doing that we even get into estoppel. The 20 doctors who relied on this summary plan description in and of itself supports the fact that it's a summary plan description. I mean, you can't go for 20 years with the only documents the doctors are receiving as being these pamphlets and say that's not the summary plan description. It contains the elements of a summary plan description. It has the benefit formula. It tells how you can they can be denied or you can lose benefit.
Who's the custodian of the actual plan?
Well, the administration at Carl Clinic Association.
Right, and wasn't Dr. Helfrich on the committee for some period of time?
Dr. Helfrich was on both the board. He was chairman of the board. He while on the board, pointed out later that this problem.
Right, but I guess I had a little bit of trouble understanding why he didn't have access to the plan itself if he was in that kind of leadership position?
Well, because he gets what the administration gives him.
He can't ask.
Well, yeah, he did. He ultimately did. He ultimately did ask for it. And
no, but in a management capacity, I guess I'm asking, not as a potential recipient.
It's not that kind of. It's a board where, you know, you're given information and it's controlled by the CEO of the clinic.
This is because it was then and not now. I don't think boards of directors are comfortable being that passive after the last couple of years.
Well, I think
it's not simply the last couple of years. Any board that said it was operated in that way is just in per se liability under state law. Even with a self-exculpation clause under Delaware law, a board that says it's run that way had better open its checkbook.
Well, ultimately, isn't that what happened here? Ultimately, we had a pension, an underfunded pension fund that Dr. Helfrich pointed out.
What's the size of this clinic in terms of physicians?
Well, we don't know it from the record, but
well, I don't know it from the briefs either. So
right. Well, I mean, I'd be answering outside the record. That's my problem. See, I hesitate to do that because, you know, a medium-sized downstate clinic. I mean, how else can I say it? But having 20 doctors respond this way. The way they did, and to have Carl respond.
Well, that's why there's no context. 20 doctors out of 150 or 20 out of 20?
Well, I guess I understand that, but again, how can I answer that without violating going outside the record? And I don't think that's appropriate.
If you sympathize with that position, it just undercuts your argument.
Well, you know, it's not the Mayo Clinic.
Sounds like bigger than a bread box.
Yeah.
All right, but in any event, there were 20 doctors who complained about the.
That's right, and Carl's response was to recognize that the promise had been made, and to then say, okay, we're going to rectify the promise. Here's $2 million.
For 16 people, right?
Well, 20 doctors were tendered the $2 million. In
so they're basically 100, I don't know if it's proportional or not, 100,000 apiece.
Well, sure, obviously it's going to be calculated based on a proportion of the benefit you would have received had the promise been properly funded.
Mm-hmm.
And if Carl was confident that what they'd done was satisfy the problem, then they wouldn't have said, now you must sign a release to get the money. So instead, they recognize that the problem's there, they recognize the good faith of these doctors' argument, the 20, but then they say you must sign a release. And because our doctors don't sign a release, then it's suggested somehow that their claims are frivolous or that they've acted in bad faith. I'll save my time. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Solons. Oh, sorry. Mr. Beckett, I'm sorry.
May it please the court, Michael Pollard. I'm
Mr. Pollard.
Let me begin by responding to Judge Wood's questions about the complaint. I don't think a promissory estoppel claim was fairly raised ever in this complaint. I don't think a promissory estoppel claim was ever raised fairly until summary judgment. And with respect to the issue that now is predominant on this appeal, even Judge McCuskey wrote a footnote in his opinion, page 19. It appears that plaintiff may argue now there's some discrepancy in a summary plan description. And so I must confess, of the many, many appeals I've argued in my career, this is the oddest procedural posture I've been before the court. And one of the reasons is the complaint alleged four counts. It alleged an ERISA violation in count one for Dr. Helfrich, count three for Dr. Nelson, and it specifically set forth statutory provisions of ERISA relating forfeiture and reduction of accrued benefits. Those claims are not before you here, although they were fully briefed, argued, all of that before the court.
Well, yeah, Judge McCuskey decides that this change in the expression of the formula wasn't a substantive change. It was just a different way.
Right, and there's no appeal.
Playing with the math.
Right,
yeah.
There is no appeal from that at all. So that was the claim. Now, remember, this also proceeds with the course of administrative review. Mr. Beckett wrote a letter and asked for additional benefits under the plan, and the plan response is, we're going to treat this now, after all this colloquy, as a plan for benefits. Here's how you do it.
But wouldn't you agree, though, Mr. Pollard, I mean, putting these problems, which I'm not trivializing at all. They're issues, and we'll deal with them to one side. The language in these pamphlets squarely contradicts the language in the plan. These pamphlets say you're going to get this 50% benefit, and the plan has 50% only up until the IRS cap. 50% of final average pay isn't the same thing as some number that's capped.
Well, I think what they do is they describe a level of benefits, and there wouldn't be a pension plan in the world that has Section 415 implications if there wasn't a description of benefits. And so what that does is defines the level of benefits.
But the ordinary person reading this language in Summary 3, which in bold face says, for retirement at age 65 with 30 or more years of service, the plan provides a monthly income of 50% of final average pay, crowning the clinic-paid part of your Social Security, but not the rest of Social Security. Most people would think, okay, I can do the math on that. You know, I'll pull my pay stubs, I'll figure out what my final average pay was and adjust for Social Security, and there I am. That's not what they're going to get because of 415. And I'm sure the plan had every good reason in the world to have the 415 limit in it, but if that wasn't communicated, there's
and
a problem.
And 415 limits were reduced in 1986, which is what triggers a lot of this. It became more of a problem subsequently. And
right.
In fact, on that specific point, on the estoppel claim, in his administrative appeal at page E316 of the materials, the supplementary material submitted here, Dr. Helfrich writes that he was aware as early as 1984 of some question about creating an alternative arrangement. And so here he is in 1984 knowing that. He subsequently becomes chief of the medical staff. He subsequently serves on the Pension and Benefit Committee. I don't think there's any suggestion that even if full discovery had been permitted here that there's any reasonable reliance here, nor with respect to Summary 3, that summary, unlike the other two, refers the individual back to the plan, which, had they seen it, would have invoked the Section 415 limit. So I don't think Summary 3 can create an estoppel claim at all. And really what you have is these informal brochures, Brochure 1 and 2, which omit reference to ERISA statutes, which would cause disqualification of the plan. So I think the court should be quite loath to require a payment out of a plan in excess of Section 415 limits, which would lead to the disqualification of the plan. That gets to, well, then where does the money come from, which is the state law breach of contract claim, which Judge McCuskey correctly found to be preempted here and which is not appealed before you, that somehow there is some state law-governed excess benefit plan, but that's not before you. That hasn't been appealed. And so it's either, all I think the court has before it is a promissory estoppel about a pension claim, which, if you award the benefits, would lead to the potential disqualification of the plan.
Well, but
and
see,
I think
that's not impossible, though. I mean, suppose, I mean, you could say that this particular plan just blew it. You know, maybe they promised more than they were entitled by law to promise if they wanted to retain their status as a qualified plan. But if they made that promise to people, and that's what, and if there really was an SPD, and if that SPD really did conflict with the plan, it does happen that plans become unqualified. It's very expensive, of course, a terrible thing for those who administer the plan, and also the beneficiaries, for that matter. I mean, everybody suffers, but it's not impossible. It's just undesirable from your client's point of view, right?
Well, I think this court's been loath to apply estoppel plan.
Estoppel, yes, but we do look at cases a lot where there's a claim that the SPD has, where the benefits claimed are calculated by a formula in the SPD.
Right. Well, I don't think that claim has ever been adequately presented.
All right, that's
McCuskey,
the claim.
And he should have decided. He should have decided on that basis. He indulged. Plaintiff with footnote 19, but I don't think estoppel applies here.
Has the plan, by the way, done the calculation about whether the plaintiffs would be better off under the relief they seek? That is, if the cap were lifted and the plan were no longer a tax-qualified plan, I assume there would be terrible tax consequences, both for the plan and for the plaintiffs.
I think that's correct.
Because all of their prior pre-retirement contributions they would now retroactively have to pay tax on it.
They haven't done the calculation, but there would be
Internal Revenue Service would be much better off under the plaintiff's position. Do we know whether the plaintiffs would be better off under the plaintiff's position?
I don't, but I do know there would be tax consequences. I will say this, however, that in the particular facts and circumstances of this case, it certainly doesn't warrant that result, because after plaintiff, Dr. Helfrich, exhausted all of his administrative remedies, and this is clear from document E-316 of the supplementary materials, Carl did keep open the opportunity for him to participate in the lump sum distribution, which is paid, which was going to be distributed according to seniority, among other factors, 75% of it according to a seniority factor. And so he was entitled to participate even after his administrative appeal was denied. So given his knowledge of this issue dating as early as 1984, the fact that this offer was continued to be available to him into late 1999, even after his administrative appeal would be denied, he clearly would have been in the best possible situation had he accepted that offer. I don't think there's much doubt about that at all. And
I don't see what any of these arguments back and forth about settlement proposals have to do with things. You aren't even supposed to be talking about settlement proposals.
Well, it came up because that became sort of the argument that plaintiffs raised with respect to their state law claim. In fact, it's one of the prayers for relief in the complaint. Prayer for relief number 3 is they should be able to obtain that. And that's why it gets raised. That's why it was preempted. So if the court, I'll address that, I guess, the attorney's fee petition. I think Judge McCuskey was entirely appropriate and did not abuse his discretion in awarding attorney's fees in this case.
Why was your opponent required to pay things like somebody's admission fee to the district court? Seems to me that that's really offloading general costs that the firm gets a long-term benefit out of. It's not all clear to me.
I suppose because there was no objection to that.
They mention it in their brief here.
I don't recall an objection being made to that at the district court. The specific objections that they made on the attorney fee petition totaled about $13,500. Judge McCuskey found that all of them, in fact, were related to and were incident to the regular conduct.
Right, I know he found that, but I mean, some of them, it seemed to me, it might have been a little hasty, because some of them did, I mean, like for this admission fee, for example, was within that 13,000 and some number.
Well, as I saw it, there was $885 for a press release. This case generated some immediate attention at the instigation, so there was less than $1,000 with that up front. There was $3,000 examining insurance coverage type issues. There was $2,500 after I got involved in the case preparing, revising, and formulating a budget, which frankly wasn't all that easy given that one didn't know what the course of this case was going to be. Were there going to be 20 depositions or was there going to be nothing?
But you must deal with that all the time.
I do. I mean, I don't think that amount is totally unreasonable, nor do I think the rates are terribly unreasonable. And it's not something that I take lightly. This is the first time in an ERISA case as a prevailing defendant I've sought fees after handling these cases for 20 years. And I think it was because this case was far more protracted than I think it needed to be. And frankly, because of the tactics that were pursued, far less expensive with no difference in the result, I think, than if all the 20 depositions and trial and all that had been conducted. Frankly, I think
Had you had experience dealing with physicians, clients like this in prior ERISA cases?
I have represented many physicians in my day. I think Judge McCuskey was correct in awarding fees. I think there's minimal argument about the amount of the fees. The fees were supported by affidavit. Judge McCuskey found them to be entirely appropriate. And I think ultimately in this case, it's proper that they were awarded in that amount, because I think had the case proceeded as plaintiffs had planned it, they easily would have spent that amount of money on their own attorneys, regardless of what the difference in rates was. And so with that, I would ask that the case be affirmed in all of its respects.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Pollard. Anything further, Mr. Beckett?
With all due respect to Mr. Pollard, just as I wouldn't go outside the record to tell you the size of the clinic.
Don't worry. You're the website.
No, I'm
we just looked at the website.
Okay, good. Well, I just want to tell
more
you
more than 300
right. With all due respect, Mr. Pollard's experience wasn't presented to the district court. Was not. I mean, I think Judge Easterbrook pretty much hit the nail on the head. I think Judge McCuskey was upset with us regarding our discovery request. He invited the attorney's fees petition, and he nailed these plaintiffs, to use a phrase. And I think one of the concerns that I have about that attorney's fees issues is here you have these doctors, and I recognize that lawyers and doctors are not a very sympathetic class, but it's no different than somebody from...
Lawyers are a much more sympathetic class.
Yes, Judge.
Particularly in litigation.
That what we're talking about is two plaintiffs who were part of this group of 20, who you talked about it being a settlement, Judge Easterbrook. This was not a settlement. It's not in here because it was a settlement. It was these doctors made this claim. You promised us you're going to pay us this benefit. Now you're not doing it. And Carl said, this is what you're getting, period, and signed this release. That's not a settlement discussion. That is not. And these doctors are part of that group who, in good faith, believe that they have an honest claim. And they come forward, and an insurance company comes in, and now they have to pay $160,000 divided by two because of it. And that just is a bit much. That the message that it's sending is, even if you in good faith have a claim that has merit, and Judge Wood, you acknowledge this conflict between the summary plans. I mean, that's existing case law. That's not something that was just made up out of whole cloth. That when you have a good faith claim like that, you ought to be able to come to court with it without the thought that loser pays. It's not the English rule, unless the court has any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now the case will be taken under advisement.